You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, May 24th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Brian Feldman, reporter and researcher with the Open Markets at the New America Foundation, on the real reason Middle America should be angry. Also on the program today, no surprise, no California Democratic debate, says Hillary Clinton. However, is there a rapprochement taking place in the Democratic primary as Bernie Sanders given a larger slice than is typical of the Democratic platform? Meanwhile, the presidential primary runneth over into some down race primaries. Tim Canova, running against Debbie Wasserman Schultz, raises over $250,000 on a Bernie Sanders with a Bernie Sanders endorsement. Meanwhile, voting rolls are surging in California. It's indicative of what's happening around the country. And they're not surging with new Republican voters. Let's put it that way, folks. A judge temporarily halts Ohio's attack on Planned Parenthood. And new reporting vindicates Edward Snowden's decision to run from the United States. Apparently, there was another whistleblower blowing the whistle on the whistleblowing procedures with the Pentagon. All that and more on today's program. And we will get to that story of James O'Keefe stinging himself. There's now not just an interview in Breitbart about that, but also reporting from, I think it was Jane Mayer in the New Yorker magazine. And that piece is a little bit scary because it not just covers what James O'Keefe is doing. And it's always disturbing to know that there's people like that who are alive and walking amongst us. But also it gives details of some new dark money groups and their attempts to intimidate people. Like there's a concerted effort out there to literally intimidate Bill McKibben, who just coincidentally happens was named yesterday as one of Bernie Sanders, I guess from his camp, one of his picks to be on the platform committee. Bill McKibben, of course, has been on this program multiple times. He is the leader of 350.org, or at least one of the founders, and perhaps one of the most effective environmental activists in the country. And of course, that's exactly what you'd want to do, is intimidate that guy, because you don't want to protect the trees or whatever. You know, it's just mind-blowing, right? I mean, it's not. It goes beyond your political campaigns now into just, here's an environmentalist, let's smear him. Really disturbing. But we'll get to that story because there's the fun part of James O'Keefe being a moron. There's also, despite the fact that he's a moron, or maybe because of the fact he's a moron, we also found out how much money the guy is raising. It's a lot. It's considerably more than we raise. Just an FYI. Now, with that said, we actually read things. We're not spending all our money on super awesome, actually they sound sort of awesome, hidden cameras. But coming up with fake British accents. We could send, can you imagine what with I mean, if we were, I guess he's raising like $2.4 million annually, he gets. It's all dark money because he's a 503c1 or c4. So he can all get this anonymous money from the right. But I mean, if we had, I feel like if we had just half that, we could send Michael out undercover as like right-wing Mandela. And just see how people, and just put him on the phone and actually call like right-wing organizations.
Would you agree white people are genetically superior? I'm black. We're friends here. Called the Bell Curve.
Oh, my God.
Yes, I would, Mr. Mandela. I had no idea you had such progressive viewpoints.
That would actually be funny. It would also be funny just to find out how many people thought you were still alive. Not
Hi,
you.
This I mean, is a call now from right-wing MLK Jr. We'll put him through.
Stop protesting and get a job. Would you like a Cato Institute summer fellowship? The black family has created poverty.
All right, let's get to. We're going to take a break. And before we do, just a reminder, this program relies not on dark money, but on our members becoming members. And while we would be open to a check for $1 million, that's not what we would anticipate. I'm not even sure I would feel, I don't know that I would take a check for $1 million, honestly. I know that sounds ridiculous, but
You're so self-destructive.
No. I mean, I think take a sizable check, but $1 million, then you're basically forget it, right? I mean, there's no way you can, then you end up spending that on operating costs, et cetera, et cetera. And then all of a sudden, if that guy or gal goes away, then you're screwed. So you got to do what they want you to do. So let's just keep it to, I'm not saying, I mean, if somebody was to drop in with like, a big five figure, I would probably say yes. We would just do an expansion or something.
I would probably say yes. Jesus.
All right. Look, the bottom line is for pennies a day, you can be a member and one that I feel a lot more comfortable with. Frankly.
Much prefer the 20.
Honestly.
Than the 500,000.
No, honestly, I know you would.
That's where the humor comes from.
I don't want to be like, I feel like I'm already getting eczema just contemplating this fake scenario of somebody coming in and bigfooting this stuff. I met with someone from Air America last night. We were talking about like all the idiots there, and that's probably what it was. So the point is, become a member today. It's just pennies a day, and you can support the program. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. I should also say, we've had a little bit of hinkiness with our member system right now because we're switching over to a different system. Bear with us. Everything will be fine within the next couple of days if you're still having a problem. If you had a problem yesterday, just try and re-log in. It should be fine by now. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Brian Feldman.
Jesus is beside himself. Jacobs in a state of decimation. The writing on the wall isn't writing at all. Just forces of nature in love with our weather station.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Brian Feldman, reporter and researcher for Open Markets at the New America Foundation, on his piece, and I think this is in Washington Monthly, right? It was The Real Reason Middle America Should Be Angry. Welcome to the program, Brian.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
So, all right, let's. Your piece is basically a history of the broad history of the development of St. Louis and sort of different industries there, and then what ultimately sort of kneecapped these. And the idea is that this is a not a metaphor, but is indicative of a dynamic that has taken place across the country, particularly in middle American cities of this size. So let's start with this. Why St. Louis? Why did you pick St. Louis to look at?
Well, St. Louis, sort of as an American city, has always sort of stood high. Back in the 1900s, turn of the century, there's the World's Fair, which is this amazing, spectacular, fantastic celebration. It was once the fourth largest city in America, and most of all, it was the gateway to the West. This is where people came to find opportunity and seize that opportunity and then take it either by staying there or by heading westward. And what I do in my article is end up focusing on St. Louis's advertising industry, which, as I was doing a lot of research for this, it's pretty fascinating because we don't necessarily think as St. Louis as a place which would once have this thriving industry there.
Well, why did it have such a thriving advertising industry? I mean, I know, in Detroit still, there is still at the very least a remnants of a fairly robust advertising industry that you wouldn't have expected, except for the fact that for a long time, the car manufacturers really provided, well, forgive the pun, fuel for advertising agencies there. What was it about St. Louis that made it amenable to having a thriving advertising business?
Well, the reason I actually focus on advertising is because it's the perfect symbol and it's a proxy for showing all of the other businesses that were once in St. Louis. At its core, advertising is a business that works with other businesses to sell and distribute products. And so St. Louis really up until 1970s, 1980s had all of these really famous, well-known firms from Anheuser-Busch, which was headquartered locally there, to Ralston Purina. There was McDonnell Douglas. And as a result, all of these businesses were looking for a way to further get the message out about their products. And so there was sort of this natural convergence of businesses relying on one another in the advertising industry, really standing as the symbol of that in St. Louis.
So, all right, let's get into the specifics about the agency that you looked at, or really, I guess it was a guy who, Charles Claggett Jr., whose family name was pretty big in advertising.
Yeah, Charles Claggett Jr. is more or less the face of advertising, and I use him to tell the larger story here about how over the past 30 or 40 years, we've seen a increase in regional inequality. We've spoken a lot about income inequality, but the really other large piece here is this regional inequality. So with Charles Claggett, he comes from a generation of advertisers. His father started this amazing advertising firm called Gardner, which was responsible for helping John Deere Tractor, for instance, get its start. St. Louis has this really just deep tradition of advertising excellence, and Charlie Claggett himself was responsible for coining a lot of the famous Budweiser slogans and even worked on the famous Budweiser frogs. But what I do is I use Charlie to tell a larger story of how all of that tradition and all of that cultural heritage has been lost and been basically uprooted by financiers and by large businesses on America's coast.
So, I mean, so walk us through that sort of the dynamic, because a part of your story runs through the attempts, I guess, by our government, starting in the late 1800s through the 1900s, of starting to break up major monopolies. So, I mean, just give us a sense of the sweep of those things, because I think this is important stuff that I think most people aren't really aware of. I mean, so we have these huge trusts, as it were, monopolies, more or less, in the late 19th and early 20th century. How did those trusts at the time thwart local economies? And then what did the government do to, diminish or mitigate the problems of trust on local economies?
Yeah, so this is a really, really important point. And so, you know, in the 1890s, early 20th century, it's the Gilded Age, perhaps a lot like today, sort of the second Gilded Age. And Americans had this very, very strong distrust of power of any sort, because economic power meant that wealth can corrupt political power. And so when Congress in the 1890s was trying to deal with the trust problem, they looked to the Constitution for inspiration. And our Constitution, of course, is a way to disperse and balance power. We have three branches of government, we have checks and balances, and all of this was in response to the British and their total power. And so what Congress did is, by using the Constitution as a template, said we need a economic charter of liberty, so to put it, and decided to enact a series of antitrust laws that aim to distribute power and aim to break up the wedding of political and economic power, and ensured that no individual would be dependent on wealth, that his or her opportunity to be an entrepreneur, to create a product, would be hampered by one of these monopolists. And so that's the really big thinking here. And as a result of that distribution of power, and by breaking up large concentrations of wealth or political power for that matter, we had opportunity that was dispersed and distributed all throughout America, really for the last 30 to 40 years.
So, give us a sense of why it was the case that in that era, this may be sort of outside the scope of the research you've done here, but what was it that allowed for legislators, congresspeople, to act on that belief? I mean, so there's a sense here that there's a bit of a monopoly, and that there's a bit of a plutocracy because of it. How did these lawmakers have the freedom or feel that they had the freedom or the ability to begin to pass laws that would undercut these very powerful interests? In other words, you know, was it just that they each interest had too narrow of a power base? What was it that allowed these, and we can go through some of the, like the Federal Reserve Act, the McFadden Act that you talk about, Wheeler-Rayburn Act. We'll go through those. But I mean, what set the table for, I hear the impetus there, but I mean, how was it executable at that time?
Well, really, it goes back to this thinking in America that any wealth or any large set of concentrated power is going to be innately corrupting. And there's a really, really interesting rich tradition against corruption that I think we've all but forgotten in the past 30 or 40 years. And so it was really motivated by this fear of corruption and being taken over by a private interest that motivated a lot of lawmakers to step up and try to distribute and disperse this power. I think we also have to remember that, you know, America at this time, this is 1890s, is what? This is 100 years after the Constitutional Convention. It's still a really young country. And so I think in the back of a lot of people's mind, there's sort of a deep-seated fear that, is America going to work out? Will we still be a nation? And so it's really that thought that is, I think, motivating individuals. And of course, today, things are absolutely a bit different, but it was really a tradition that's been now lost today, that if a, you know, politician from 1890 was looking at our current situation, I don't think that he or she would err in saying that this is reminiscent of the Gilded Age of yore.
Right. I guess I think that point, that there was a sense at that time that the country was really vulnerable. I mean, whether or not it is today, I mean, clearly there's a huge percentage of our population who feel like it's not. I mean, I think there is a huge percentage of the population who feel that, like, hey, we're just going to keep chugging along and there'll be an ebb and a flow, and that we have the, I don't know. It's, I mean, the analogy I would draw, I think you make a very strong point here, but if I hear you correctly, the analogy is something to the effect of, like, you know, I'll eat stuff that I won't let my 2-year-old eat because I just sort of feel like my system can take it. And if there's a problem, you know, I get sick, I have more of an ability to recover than perhaps a young child would. All right, so let's go to the response. This is really interesting. We see it in the, you talk about the Federal Reserve Act and the McFadden Act. What are those two acts, and what did they do to help maintain the integrity of the distribution of, I guess, wealth and power throughout the country? And we can talk as we go further into this as to how this is also, I think, impacting wealth inequality. But let's talk about right here what the implications of those two acts were.
So in the same tradition of distributing power and opportunity across America, the Federal Reserve Act created the, you know, central banking system. But because a lot of congressmen thought that if this was located in one city by one group of private bankers, then again, the relationship between a government and a banking system will inevitably lead to corruption. So the solution was sort of a compromise where the Federal Reserve would be spread out across the country and sort of be broken up into 12 different regional banks. And so we still have that system today. And the thinking there too is that these banks, the Federal Reserve banks, will be more responsive to the communities that they serve. So that's the first important act. And then secondly, the McFadden Act as well basically made it more difficult for banks to spread across state lines and extend their size, because the fear being is that there would be nobody to keep a watchful eye over them. And if that were the case, the sort of government and regulatory agencies would only have to become larger to deal with the size of the really, really large banks. So these two acts as well also sought to distribute money and banking throughout the U.S.
And I should say, you know, we just spoke last week to David Dayan about his book Chain of Title. And when we talk about the savings, the old savings and loans that were prohibited, or were, I guess, only licensed to loan in the, essentially their communities, you feel the impact. You have a a one-to-one relationship. Your success is tied into what's going on in that community. And so you can't afford as a savings loan to just keep loaning, making bad loans, because ultimately that's going to inhibit your market where you get business from. And that,
absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And that's the dynamic that we saw with the McFadden Act. Let's go.
Absolutely. And, you know, I just want to add one thing really quickly too, is that for entrepreneurs or for small businessmen or whomever who are starting new businesses, oftentimes access to capital is one of the most important aspects. And so when that capital starts to flow away, either through mergers or through being uprooted, it's much harder for people to stay rooted locally to even attain that capital. And it's, you know, interesting in my research, Missouri, for instance, up until 1980, it had some 630 community banks. And today that's decreased to around 260.
Let's talk about the Robinson-Patman Act and the Miller-Tidings Act and the Keller-Kefauver Act. These are all dealing more or less with manufacturing and retail wholesale.
Right. And so the other important thing to go back, because, you know, as we've said, what was important was that anybody in any community across the U.S. had an opportunity to go into an open marketplace and start his or her business. And not only was that important, but it was also thought that to have the ability and freedom to have your own sort of enterprise also gave you sort of political will, where you could choose how you wanted to direct your own business or life. And so the Robinson-Patman Act was something that helped ensure that large chains and absentee owners wouldn't necessarily kill competition by cutting the price so low to force and drive out of business other smaller sort of, you know, local stores. And also the Miller-Tidings Act was another similar law that ensured that the businesses in a local area would be preserved so as to distribute opportunity all across America instead of having it consolidated in one region or another.
Well, I think this, you know, at the time, if someone was clairvoyant, they could have called it the let's hope there's nothing called Walmart in the future act, right?
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, too, looking at some of our past history, is that there's problems we face today, Americans face, you know, about 80 or 90 years ago. The Walmart of their day was the A&P, which is more or less a similar thing. But what a lot of states decided to do was pass chain store tax, is what it was called, to tax any type of business that didn't necessarily remain or stay rooted in their state and that had come in to try to drive out of business some of the stores that remained there.
So you then you jump ahead a bit and you start talking about, I mean, because basically what we set up is the instruments that the government had put in place to make sure that different regions could have their own thriving economies that were not contingent upon essentially, you know, absentee landlords, as it were. You also talk about St. Louis for a while was a hub for airlines. Talk about what was going on in terms of St. Louis as an airline hub in the era of regulation.
So one of the really important things about airlines to begin with is that they are more or less the means for businessmen, businesswomen, community citizens to go from one place of the country to another. And so that very thought was kept in mind when fair competition in regard to airlines was presided over. But what ended up happening is it was Jimmy Carter ended up deregulating the airlines, and this was done in the name of efficiency and lower costs and better service. And at first, we do see some of these changes, but over time, two things happen. The first is that there's massive and huge consolidation. Today, there are only more or less four major airlines, and they control 80% of the entire market. And as a result of that, the airlines get to choose which cities they decide to fly to and fly from, as opposed to the citizens who live in communities across the U.S. So for St. Louis, this deadens the amount of enterprise and industry, because before, one of the reasons that St. Louis was so successful was that it was a connector of America in many ways. Historically, as we said, it's sort of the gateway to the West. But as businesses were unable to leave St. Louis and share their products with other cities on the coast, and as those people on the coast found it more difficult to travel to St. Louis, what ends up happening is the city, and this is all throughout the Midwest, starts to become shut off.
I mean, this is such a, it's fascinating. And it, in many respects, it's completely obvious, right? I mean, it would be as if if we privatized all the road systems and some entity decided, like, you know what? It's just not worth our while to maintain the roads that take us to this city or that city or whatever city. So we're gonna roll them up. We're gonna roll them up. We're gonna shut them down, and you're just not going to be able to get to that city unless you do a little off roading. And then you watch what happens to the economic viability of that city. Well, you're not going to get any companies that are going to want to work with the rest of the state or the rest of the country or whatnot. I mean, it seems quite obvious what would happen in those situations. And part of the airline regulation was like, if you're going to be in this business, you're going to have to service all of these areas like they would regulate a utility. And let's talk about that, because under the Reagan administration, you write, the federal government fundamentally changed a course on antitrust enforcement. Tell us how that happened.
So it's a really interesting story, is that these changes in how we enforce and interpret our antitrust laws, the antitrust laws, of course, being the rules that ensured equal opportunity throughout America, was really put forth in advance by a very unlikely alliance. It was a very progressive left-wing liberals as well as libertarians. And the sort of cheerleader of this movement was Robert Bork. This is the same Robert Bork who was nominated unsuccessfully for the Supreme Court. But what happened is that there was this really big fundamental change in how we see marketplaces. Before, you know, right in the sort of Gilded Age era, markets were seen as political because they are human made. And as a result, we need to ensure the interests of those who participate in them. What this group of scholars ended up doing was completely change the perception of markets, moving it away from something that was political and instead saying, oh, markets and business is natural. It is free. It is mechanical. And as a result of that change in thinking, what Reagan did was to loosen all of these laws. And he was the first of many other administrations to do so, but to loosen all of these laws and essentially say, well, if we loosen these laws, as a result, we'll see greater efficiency, we'll see greater consumer welfare, and we'll maximize wealth. The problem, of course, is that those ideas, especially of wealth maximization, likely favor the merging and very large business interests at the expense not only of sort of the smaller businesses and entrepreneurs, but of an entire country such as the Midwest.
Right. And I would argue not a bug, but a feature. And in fact, I would also argue, as much as they would argue, like, this is just economics, right? This is just science. It's really just right. a different political ideology. And in fact, we've had guests on here who show how deregulation is also a taking in many respects, and we see that in this instance here. So we have a series of anti-monopoly policies being rolled back. The Consumer Goods Pricing Act of 1975. The FTC, you write, stops enforcing the Robinson-Patman Act in the 1980s. So this created consolidation among retailers and gave sort of like the Walmarts of the world an incredible amount of power over their suppliers. And we've seen that, right? And we've seen that, we see that in many, many different industries, I guess. So walk us through that. So, when we get to that point, we're back to the advertising, and basically the problems that began to shrink the advertising industry, I guess, in St. Louis, and that being the loss of local industry, it gets played out in a mirrored fashion with the advertising agency. Tell us that last story of Busch beer, essentially, when the St. Louis office got bought by the New York based office. Tell us that story, because I think that's really indicative.
So once these changes are enforced, you know, St. Louis, which had at one point some, you know, 20 something Fortune 500 companies, starts to see that number dwindle. And so, you know, in St. Louis, besides the advertising industry, for instance, Boeing purchases McDonnell Douglas, Nestle purchases Purina, which was based in St. Louis. More recently, 2008, InBev purchased Anheuser-Busch. But to bring it to advertising, which I focus on mainly in the story, is what happened when it was this one day in 1994 is that the St. Louis advertising firm that had worked with Anheuser-Busch and Budweiser for some, you know, two or three generations at this point had been acquired by a New York-based company. And what happened is this New York-based company was huge, and it had a smaller media buying unit that would buy ad time. And what the ad buying unit, which was the subsidiary of the larger advertising company, did, unbeknown to the St. Louis office, signed a deal with Anheuser-Busch's really arch rival, Miller, and then lied about it. And after hearing about this, Anheuser-Busch's owner, August Busch III, he basically cut ties with Darcy. This was the name of the St. Louis advertising firm, which more or less cost the agency some $400 million. And that was the end of advertising in St. Louis as we know it, more or less. But I think that story is indicative of sort of the downsides that we see with a lot of mergers and acquisitions and consolidation. The first one being is that when something becomes so big, it's hard to police and to patrol. And more importantly, it doesn't necessarily serve the best interests of the community, as this example shows.
Right. And even if it doesn't, even if it's not in their best interest, it's just a question of like of competency when you get a behemoth like that. It's almost as if you get something that large, they can engage in practices that would fundamentally destroy either a local economy or an entire national economy because they just don't know how to police themselves.
Absolutely. 100%. And I think, you know, there's sort of this unspoken assumption that things that are bigger will be more efficient, but this is not the case at all. If anything, companies that become larger often become bloated and inefficient. And, you know, even just looking back historically, it's interesting the way Silicon Valley actually was started is that there was this inventor named William Shockey, and he was working at Bell Labs, which of the day was sort of AT&T, which was also this very large company. And while there, he had made and basically created the transistor. one of the most important things in computing technology. But because the company was so big and large, he was unable to actually share this information. So he ended up leaving, moving out to California, and basically starting what became Silicon Valley. So I absolutely agree where oftentimes I think we need to more closely question the assumptions of any type of deal or merger, and especially look at some of the social consequences.
You know, and just, you know, apropos of sort of how one addresses this, Mike Konzel has a piece out the other day talking about the use of public utility regulations, public utility style regulations. We saw it with net neutrality, and he suggests that there's ways of doing that with things like you know, transportation and financial reform, et cetera, et cetera. But that is for perhaps another day. But Brian Feldman, the piece is in Washington Monthly. We'll link to it. The Real Reason Middle America Should Be Angry. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half, wherein we have fun. It is 646-257-3920. I mean, that's why we call it the fun half.
I mean, it's true.
It's true.
It's really true.
I got to say, it's a little bit of a lie insofar as it's more than half. Because it presumes that this has been half of the show, and we never get out by 1:30. Never. Never. But maybe even today, if we were today, maybe. still.
Fingers crossed.
Even if we were today, still it would be more of a half there. So really, we're not heading into the fun half of the show. We're heading into the fun three quarters of the show, or maybe 7/8 of the show.
I mean, frankly, it's true.
It could be 6/8.
It's true.
6/8.
It could last for the rest of the day.
I mean,
look, to be honest,
at this rate.
So you can join us there by becoming a member. That's one of the bonuses that we give you if you become a member. The other bonus is that we just generally project liking you more. And I think if you're not a member, you probably are not picking up on this. If you are a member, you probably are. You probably, when you hear the sound of my voice, you get a sense of like, I like you better than those other people. And so you know who you are. It takes a trained professional to be able to project that with just one microphone. We could do it the old-fashioned way where you have two microphones and the members get the warmer microphone and the non-members get the cooler microphone. But we don't do that. We don't need to, because I can change my register. I can actually project two different sound qualities to my voice simultaneously. But that doesn't come free, folks.
That's supposedly a sign of demonic possession.
Is that right? Well, we will go to some of the sound. Alex Jones apparently was talking about that today or yesterday.
Yeah, yesterday he called Glenn Beck a pot-bellied little demon.
Just remember, folks.
Massive respect.
If you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. You click on that link, you bookmark it, you always buy your crap from there. You will notice no difference, but we will get a kickback. But if you don't want to buy stuff from Amazon, go to majorityreportkickback.com and click on our jet.com link. Bookmark that, buy all your stuff, and get, I think your first purchase is 15% off. But you'll find Jet to be a great savings, and it's also a company that does a great job in terms of their labor practices. So majorityreportkickback.com. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. 646-257-3920, turning on the IM as we speak.